This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Etopia Media Medical News Network. We're about to speak to Karen Barth-Menzies at the law firm of Baum Hedlund. Welcome back to Etopia Media Medical News Network.
Thank you.
We're going to be talking about the Kim Witsek case. What's your connection with it from the beginning till now?
We represent Kim Witsek in her wrongful death case regarding her husband, Woody. We've sued Pfizer for her husband having committed suicide after taking Zoloft.
And where does this case now stand in the court process?
Well, we're looking towards trial. It looks like we may be set for early next year, maybe as early as January or February.
And which court is this going to be heard in?
It's in the district court, federal district court in Minnesota, so Minneapolis.
Okay. Now, there was recently, well, not that recently, but the most recent important development in the case was the rejection by the judge in Minnesota of a motion by Pfizer. Could you tell us what their motion was and how it was disposed of?
Yes. This is a very serious problem that is not going to affect only just Kim's case, but actually all cases around the country, even any pharmaceutical case. It's basically a brief filed by the Department of Justice, which is the counsel for FDA.
And the U.S. Department of Justice.
That's correct.
Right.
And they filed a brief on behalf of FDA saying that even if the drug company knew about the suicide risk related to the drug, if they had warned about it, the FDA would not have allowed them to warn about it. They would have considered it misbranding, and so therefore the lawsuit should not go forward.
Now, what's the standing of the U.S. Justice Department or the FDA in a lawsuit between allegedly aggrieved victim and a private corporation?
Well, Mark, that's what's so egregious about the steps that they've been taking. They're coming in, intervening on behalf of FDA, but in favor of the drug company and not of the consumer. They do it in a manner where they file what's called an amicus brief or a friend of the court brief. So they don't have specific standing. They're not a party to the lawsuit, but they're advising the court on what they should do. Now, the court is free to reject or accept the opinion of the counsel for FDA, and this court has flatly rejected it.
Okay. Now, what was the involvement in this particular case, or more generally, on this issue of a former FDA chief counsel, Daniel Troy?
Dan Troy was the original chief counsel who filed a similar brief, and it's referred to, the issue is referred to as the preemption brief. And basically, it's part of his effort, along with the administration, I think, currently, on tort reform. They're trying to stop all lawsuits before any of the lawsuits get to the merits of the case. And their basic platform is that if a drug was approved by FDA, even though it was approved 10 years or 15 years ago, if it was approved, you cannot bring a lawsuit against the drug company for a failure to warn about a side effect, even if the drug company knew about the side effect, even if the drug company hid the side effect from both consumers and even FDA.
Without going into the political motivation here, what's the legal basis for a claim like that?
Well, I don't think there is one. They're actually trying to stretch it. There's been one case that addressed the issue of preemption in a car manufacturing situation. They've really been trying to stretch that decision across all others, despite numerous recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions and a long history of decisions that have been against the preemption of pharmaceutical cases.
Okay, now, last year in July, I did an interview with Congressman Hinchey, who was calling for the resignation of Mr. Troy on the basis of what he characterizes as a conflict of interest. Mr. Troy is no longer there, I guess, isn't he?
No, he's not. He apparently was willing to take these very controversial steps on behalf of the goals of the administration in a way that it caused great upset within his own industry, even, and even his own colleagues, professors in the area of administrative law, and of course attorneys and even congressmen were recognizing that this is very much out of character, not supported, not a position FDA should take. I mean, basically, he's arguing that FDA is not allowed to, or let me take that back. He's trying to stop any lawsuit that would expose side effects related to a drug that the FDA has missed.
Right. Now, the acting director of the FDA was just confirmed as director and then 2 weeks later resigned.
Yeah.
What's going on over there, and does that have anything to do with these kind of issues?
Well, you know, it's hard for us to tell, but it certainly appears that there's serious turmoil within the agency, because what we've seen is a lot of safety advisors and experts at FDA that are looking at the actual issues. And they raised these concerns to their senior officials, and the senior officials basically squelched their efforts to try to make the public and physicians aware of the risk.
And Mr. Graham testified, yep. And how does that tie into this?
It's all part of the picture. I think that we're really, the FDA failures are really being exposed and have been through not only the SSRI antidepressant hearings, but also the Vioxx hearings. And it's, you know, really showing underlying problems, and there's the agency right now has it set up where the senior officials can basically trump and ignore what their own safety officers are telling them should be done to make these drugs safer, and the senior officials are just, you know, in too cozy of a relationship with the pharmaceutical companies.
Other forces as well. The woman in charge of the Plan B analysis resigned last week.
Right.
Because that panel was overruled by senior officials.
Yep.
In that case, though, it was to not allow a drug to go on the market over the counter, not because it wasn't safe, but because of nebulous considerations which haven't been really released.
Right.
What's the significance in this whole process of the fact that rather than being marketed solely to physicians, drugs are now largely being marketed to consumers over television?
Right, that's the key problem, and it's interesting because people like Dan Troy have, when he was representing Pfizer in cases before he worked as chief counsel for the FDA.
You mean he used to work for the company he was filing the amicus brief for?
Yes, sir. He worked.
I'm shocked to hear that.
Yeah, real surprising. It's kind of a swinging door policy.
Can I ask now that he's resigned who he's working for now?
Yeah, he is back representing the drug companies.
Okay.
Yep. And so you can see the clear...
although from what you're saying, it wasn't really back. I mean, it was just continuing, really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, he just did it in a much more powerful way while he was acting as chief counsel for FDA.
Right. Say before I interrupted you about the direct-to-consumer marketing and how that figures into all this.
Right, and what I was saying is that he's been a huge advocate, him and his colleagues have been an advocate to obtain that direct-to-consumer advertising. They lobbied very hard to get Congress to allow that television ads, and so, you know, you see a real change in the late 80s, or the late 90s of the advertising, but on the flip side, they're not willing to tell consumers about the harms and the risks of the drugs.
Well, don't they mumble something at the end of each of the commercials where the happy person says, oh, by the way, I could, you know, drop dead at any moment from taking this?
Right. Well, now they have to, that black box warning requires them to, yes, make mention of the suicide risk, but you realize that took 15 years of very serious fighting to get. And even though that this has been a known risk since the 80s related to the SSRI antidepressants.
Now, I saw a news story yesterday saying that Paxil could be causing birth defects in pregnant women.
Yeah, we've seen that internally as well. I think there's very serious concerns about women who are both taking it while they're pregnant, what can happen to their babies, and also the withdrawal and dependency issues. You have scientific studies showing children being born with withdrawal and basically addicted to Paxil.
Now, is this a case of here we go again? Is there a whole another cycle here of with Paxil and birth defects?
That, yeah.
Your firm was bringing a very big suit about Paxil in general, wasn't it?
Yes, that's correct.
Briefly, what's the status of all that?
It's still going on. You know, unfortunately, the litigation takes years, although Glaxo, like Pfizer, now that the FDA is filing another brief, are threatening to raise that issue again of that these lawsuits should be preempted and not permitted to go forward at all. And the real problem we have with that is that just means we don't get to the merits of the case. The litigation is the only way that the public, physicians, healthcare providers, even FDA, has any way of knowing what is the real side effects of the drug. What are the risks? What is the harm?
This doesn't count as obstruction of justice, I guess.
Well, to me it feels like it is, because FDA doesn't have the power to find out what the drug company knew and when, and even Congress doesn't, unless they indict somebody and engage in a criminal investigation.
So it's really only through the discovery motions of these lawsuits that information can come out.
Absolutely, and that's what the system is set up for. For us, it's the normal procedure for you to engage in this discovery and determine what the drug company knew and when, and if they should have warned about a side effect sooner. They're trying to, Dan Troy and the rest of his colleagues are trying to preempt these lawsuits from going forward from day one, so we can never dig any of that information up.
Now that Mr. Troy is back in private practice, is he encouraging the FDA to go ahead with the innovative approach that he pioneered there?
Well, you know, I saw an interview of Bradshaw the other day where...
Tell people who that is.
He's currently sitting as chief counsel,
right.
And people have been asking him, are you going to be pursuing the same policies that Dan Troy did? And he recognizes that they're controversial, so he doesn't say yes, but he doesn't say no. Now they filed a brief, you know, just a couple weeks ago. It's clear that he's going to continue to try to make those same tort reform efforts, basically disregarding the Congress and trying to do tort reform through the back door.
Now, based on what you said, that this preemption argument made by FDA in Minnesota was rejected, you're saying they're continuing to use it.
Right.
Where else has it been been applied, and what were the results there?
They're making the argument in every case that's filed in different federal courts. So there's a different case for each suicide death, for example. Now I've been told, too, that by other attorneys who are fighting Pfizer on other drugs, that Pfizer is raising the preemption argument there as well. So this is something they're going to continue to fight for. Unfortunately, there are district court judges that, instead of looking at, you know, the law, that the support that they have to reject this brief, are inclined to think, well, this is the Department of Justice, you know, the power behind that office, may be enough for some district courts to be swayed and grant the motion.
Did Texas, Louisiana, and Illinois federal courts already reject it?
Texas courts did. There was two judges in Texas that did. Those cases are up on appeal right now. But no, there's been multiple judges since then who have rejected it. One in Louisiana, one out here in California, state court judge, Chicago.
Have any judges accepted it?
Just the two I mentioned where those cases are up on appeal right now.
In other words, the judge did accept it, and then the case was decided
It was dismissed. The cases were dismissed.
Right.
And they went up on appeal, and these were actually dismissed after the original brief that Dan Troy filed. Even though Dan Troy didn't file that brief in those two cases, Pfizer came in and argued it, and the judges accepted it. There were some kind of unique facts.
So the argument came from Pfizer rather than the Justice Department.
Oh, it's Pfizer who's running around the country carrying this brief around in their brief. Yeah. Every court they get into, they're the ones who are bringing it up. And that's what's interesting about the district court judge in the Witsack case in Minneapolis. He said, well, you know, if this is FDA's position, why didn't they file their brief in my case?
Right.
They know where I am. Why don't they, you know, I'm just right down the hall. Why don't they come in and tell me what they think? If it's something I should consider, I will. But right now, they're not in my case, and I'm rejecting it.
Now, is it possible that legislation could be put into effect to stop this, or is this an action on the part of the executive branch that's doing what it wants?
Right. It's well within, you know, I mean, unfortunately, it's the regulatory agencies that are stretching their powers as far as they'll go and hoping that there's district court judges that will bite.
Okay, but so far they're generally not.
No, they did at first, but now we've got a whole, I think, five or six of the most recent ones where they've rejected it.
Okay, I think that takes care of the preemption issue. you've filed some discoveries in this particular case with of Kim Witsack and gotten some documents. What new things have you learned from the documents that you got through discovery?
Well, what we realize, and the more documents we get, the more we've been able to confirm this, and that is that Pfizer has known that Zoloft can cause both suicide and violence in some people, and they've known that since before the drug was even approved. They've known that since the late 1980s.
Did they have a positive obligation to reveal that to FDA during the initial licensing process?
Absolutely. They have a legal duty to warn about any known side effects.
And are they in breach of any of those things? And is that fraud? Is that criminal? Is it fraud? Is it enough to decertify the drug?
Well, I think that, I mean, we believe that it is, well, now that they're warning about it, see, that's the problem.
Right.
They are warning about Zoloft-induced suicide.
And does that retroactively get them off the hook for violations they may have committed previously?
Well, FDA is trying to let them off the hook, but the lawsuits, that's the one way to keep them on the hook. That's
right.
The one deterring factor that will stop them from doing this, you know, hopefully in the future with other side effects and other drugs.
Okay, now I don't want to revert to it too much, but you were involved also with the Christopher Pittman case. How does that factor into this?
It's the same issue. It's like I mentioned before, it can cause people to become both suicidal and violent, especially kids. And Chris, unfortunately, he was a very clear case of Zoloft-induced violence. Even the jurors themselves thought that the drug caused his behavior. They just still found him guilty, which still, to this day, I don't understand.
Okay. Where do things stand overall sort of in this? It seems pretty much like a war by the drug companies against the consumers abetted by the FDA.
You named it exactly, and really what we're hoping for, Mark, is we're thrilled that we have a judge that's going to allow us to go forward on the merits. We're finally at a point in time where we're able to get to trial. Trial is coming up after the first of the year, which is, you know, by all accounts, very soon. There's only been three SSRI antidepressant trials ever in the history to have occurred. And so this will be the first against Pfizer, and we're looking forward to that exposing, you know, all of this information that the drug companies have known about for so long.
Is there the possibility of a settlement between Kim Ovitzek and Pfizer before then in order to spare them the embarrassment?
You know, I don't know. Pfizer's not settled cases with us before, and we've, but there's always the question of, you know, right when you get up to trial, both parties, you know, the judge usually kind of encourages both parties to consider talking about settlement, but
are there other legal maneuverings that they might be? Were they able? I guess they can't appeal the rejection of their preemption argument, can they?
No, I don't believe so. I mean, they definitely tried that. You know, I don't know if you've brought this out, but this last FDA brief that was just filed, that they asked the court to reconsider their preemption argument, and they filed that on Thursday afternoon. By a Friday morning, the judge had denied it. So the judge made it very clear, you know, and I think that was going to be Pfizer's last-ditch effort to try to get the case out of the court so it could not be decided on its merits. I think right now we're moving full steam ahead. We're looking forward to being able to try the case on the merits after the first of the year.
Okay, good. Well, I hope we'll be able to speak then to the limit of what you can talk about once the case is going, and keep our listeners fully informed.
Absolutely.
On the issues. Thank you very much for talking to us today on Utopia Media Medical News Network.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.